It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's the world's new hotbed of culinary inspiration, the place where cutting edges get honed. I mean Spain, where food looks and tastes like nowhere else. We talk with journalist Anya von Brimson, who's been tracking Spain's culinary evolution for a decade. Then it's quintessential American chocolate in Connecticut with Road Foods' Jane and Michael Stern. Equipment queen Dory Greenspan talks the new pressure cookers that won't stain the ceiling. We revisit a writer and rancher who's single-handedly trying to rebalance the prairie. And we check in with the man who's been kicking it up a notch for the past 10 years. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's the place where top chefs go to get their cutting edges honed, the new Center for Rethinking How Food Works. I'm talking Spain. Now, the woman who's been tracking the trend for a decade, Anya von Bremsen, has a report. Equipment pro Dori Greenspan promises no more beans on the ceiling with today's new pressure cookers. Beer man Stephen Beaumont claims there was one lager that started it all, and it came from Czechoslovakia. We revisit a writer and buffalo rancher who's single-handedly trying to rebalance the ecology of the prairie. We talk with the man who brought new meaning to the word BAM. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's get rolling with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Now, Lynn, one thing we don't talk about enough with you is chocolate. Michael and I are absolute fiends about eating lots of chocolate all the time.
Do you eat it on hot dogs by any chance, since that's the one thing you also love to talk about?
No, but when you eat a hot dog, you do need dessert, and chocolate is one of the things that fills the bill perfectly. I think one of the reasons that we love chocolate so much is that we just happen to live within a 10-minute drive of one of the best chocolatiers we have found anywhere in the world, really. Certainly the best in the U.S. It's called Bridgewater Chocolates of Brookfield, Connecticut. They make the chocolate there, and they have a little tiny store where they sell it, and it is several cuts above any chocolate that you can find almost anywhere else.
Well, do they do candies and things like that?
Yes, it's handmade candies made by a man named Eric Landgren, who does each one by hand. These are expensive chocolates. They're about $35 a pound. And before you even see the chocolate, you will be smitten by Bridgewater because they come in the most beautiful box you have ever seen. It's a navy blue grosgrain box with gold embossing that very simply says Bridgewater, and it has gold hinges on the box.
Oh,
so
my.
It's this totally tailored, elegant, gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous box. But once you open it, then you're in a whole other realm.
And I have to say that before you fall in love with the chocolate and before even you are smitten with the box, you will be horrified by the location of Bridgewater chocolate because it is the ugliest place from the outside that you've ever seen. It is located in, what would you call it, sort of an industrial complex.
Yeah.
Side by side with a gym where they and a place where they sell barbells,
a trucking company,
and I mean it looks
hideous.
Like nothing from the outside. But you walk in, you get first of all you smell, you know, the smell of it.
Right,
the chocolatier
right.
is beyond belief. You get that smell, and then you look back through a picture window beyond the showroom, and there and back they are making the chocolates before your eyes. It is a hypnotizing scene.
Okay, you want to know what I love there? And this, I guess this isn't really candy, but it is. They make dark chocolate dipped graham crackers, which have a tiny little layer, a micro thin layer of lemon cream on the graham cracker before it's dipped in this to die for dark chocolate. Or you can get lime cream with milk chocolate.
Oh, that's
It's kind of like the world's most sophisticated s'more.
And you know, Lynn, we're fans of turtles wherever we go. Their turtles at Bridgewater Chocolate are far and away the best on earth.
Do they sell only there, or do they sell to stores too?
You can get it by email.
All right.
You can write to Eric, E-R-I-K, at bridgewaterchocolate.com. And on the website, you will see everything from the graham crackers to the most wonderful. What is that thing called where it's all ungapachka with the bark?
The ungapachka bark.
The ungapachka bark.
Including one that they call kitchen sink, which is, you know, dark chocolate or light chocolate. I prefer the dark chocolate with almonds, raisins, orange peel, hazelnuts, apricots, and cranberries.
Well, this sounds sort of, I mean, the navy blue box aside, this sounds like sort of Americana,
you know, road food chocolate style, the graham crackers, the kitchen sink.
Well, road food, except for the price. It's, as Jane said, this is not inexpensive chocolate.
Right. Although whenever Michael and I go there, we always think, okay, we're going to spring for a $35 a pound chocolate. We will, you know, eat this over the next month. We'll be lucky if we get out of the parking lot before we, I mean, a pound of chocolate between two Sterns does not go very far.
And I do have to say that if you go to the showroom in of Bridgewater Chocolate, they always have little samples, a dish of samples. So we spend a lot of time perusing what we want to eat, eating the entire dish of samples.
Although they get a little aggravated if you're there for more than an hour tasting samples.
And never buy anything. Hey, guys, thank you.
Okay, Lynn, happy eating.
A smooth ride through sweet space, slidey on the tongue, very much a joyous intergalactic journey through merriment of chocolate and pure, undescribable euphoric satisfaction.
Starring among the 5-foot bookshelf of food and pop culture books by the Sterns is their classic Road Food. Now, every week you hear them here, but you can get their food finds anytime. You just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Now, chocolate dipped graham crackers with lemon cream. I mean, does this not drive you to the cookie sheet? Well, we can't let the impulse fade. So how about a fudgy little Italian cookie called chocolate coin? They're little ducats of dark chocolate and pine nuts, and they are absolutely a breeze to make. Now, in Italy, they eat them when they celebrate All Souls Night, which is November 2nd. They're supposed to look like fava beans, which are thought to hold the souls of the dear departed. Really spooky, but really good. Find the recipe for chocolate coins on the website, splendidtable.org. Dori Greenspan is an award-winning cookbook author who loves to test drive cooking equipment and gadgets. She writes the Tools of the Trade column in Bon Appetit magazine, and she shares her finds here on The Splendid Table. Hey, Dori, it's good to have you back.
Hi there. Good to be back.
Hey, Dori, what do you know about pressure cookers?
Funny you should ask. I knew nothing about pressure cookers other than my mother once made pea soup. And it was a long time before we could get those peas off the ceiling. You know, and I was talking to Lorna Sass, who's a friend of mine, who's the undisputed queen of pressure cookers. And she wouldn't even hear my story. She wouldn't listen to my story about soup because she's heard it over and over and over again. And she kept telling me, come on, you've got to try a pressure cooker. I finally gave in, and I have fallen in love. The pressure cookers that are out on the market now are not my mom's pressure cooker. You would have to go out of your way to explode one these days. They're really fabulous. I'm a new convert. You can tell.
I can tell. I can tell. Yeah. Yeah.
Only new converts are so enthusiastic. But it's a very exciting piece of equipment. Let me just tell you some of the things you can do with it before I just kind of sell you, because I know that a lot of people are afraid of pressure cookers. Risotto in 10 minutes. And really good. Beef stew, really, really delicious, fall off the bone short ribs and beef stew, 20 minutes. And beans that don't need to be soaked. Cooked, delicious beans that don't. I mean, if all you did were was to make beans and a couple of beef stews, it would really be worth the cost. Also, great soups, really wonderful soups. Chicken stock made from leftover bones, 20 minutes.
Oh, my goodness.
It's very exciting. It's very exciting. And the good news is there's a whole new generation of pots out there. And let me just, do you know how a pressure cooker works? I didn't.
No, I really don't.
Pressure cookers are actually, they've been used in Europe for generations, since well before World War II, and they haven't really changed. I mean, we're slow getting to this. It's a sealed pot, and the pressure builds up so that it's above normal inside the pot, and this causes water or any other liquid in the pot to boil at a higher temperature. So instead of boiling at 212 degrees, water boils at about 250 degrees. It's much hotter in there, the pressure is higher, and so the food in turn cooks in about one-third or sometimes even two-thirds less time. And I don't know if you remember the pressure cooker that went jiggle, 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 jingle,
yeah.
jingle, jingle.
Oh, yeah, I remember, yeah.
Right, you know, and your heart went just as fast as that little jiggle top went.
Uh-huh.
It's over. It's over.
It's gone,
it's
okay.
Gone. Instead of, I mean, you can still find one, but don't. There are now these very closely calibrated spring valves. You seal the pot, and you cannot, well, maybe you could, but I certainly couldn't pop the top because there's a release valve on top. There's a gasket with an opening so that that releases steam.
Uh-huh.
And this little spring valve on top can be pressed and the steam can be released immediately so that they're totally safe.
So give me some ideas of brands you like.
Well, there are three that I really like. I like the Swiss-made pressure cooker called Kuhn Rikon. K-U-H-N-R-I-K-O-N.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's a German pot by WMF. It's called Perfect Plus. And it's really, it's a beautiful looking pot. And the pressure control handle is removable so that it's very, very easy to clean. And then there's a big pot. I mean, I have the 8-quart pot from Spain from a company called Magafesa, I'm probably mispronouncing it, but Magefesa. And that's the least expensive of the pots, and it's also great. And they're all, I mean, when you're buying a pot, whether it's these three brands or something else, try and buy the biggest pot you can store. I mean, like a stock pot, it should really be at least 5 quarts. And the truth is, I mean, if you're going to cook in teensy quantities, then you don't need the speed that a pressure cooker is going to give you.
Mm-hmm.
And make sure, just look at the label, make sure that it cooks to 15 pounds of pressure per inch, PSI. I mean, that's really the standard that you need. You want it to seal really tightly so that it holds liquid. And you want a user-friendly system for locking the lid. You want it to lock really well, but you want to be able to do it easily and undo it easily. And you also, just as if you were looking to buy a stock pot and your pressure cooker can double as that, you want one that's going to heat evenly. So you look for a base. If you get a stainless steel pot, look for a base that has aluminum in it because aluminum is a great conductor.
What kind of prices are we looking at?
Not inexpensive. The Magafesa is the least expensive, and I found one for about $110
uh-huh.
at Cookware.
Uh-huh.
But the Kuhn Rikon is about $180. The Perfect Plus from WMF is about $200. It's an investment, but if you do what my French friends do, which is you leave it on top of your stove, you will find that you will use it several times a week. Great lentils. Oh, and a good lentil soup.
And also,
I've been having fun with it.
Yeah, and also probably great weeknight cooking. You just have to budget for it. Hey, Dori, thank you.
You're welcome.
Food Authority Dori Greenspan's column, Tools of the Trade, appears in Bon Appetit magazine. Dori's latest book is Paris Sweets. Now, her picks of the best of pressure cookers can be found right on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the place where mad science and kitchen genius is changing the world restaurant scene, Buffalo for the Broken Heart a year later, and open lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, a grocery store and Target store all in one. In addition to a complete Target store, SuperTarget features a bakery, deli, fresh produce, meats, and seafood. To find the SuperTarget nearest you, you can visit them online at target.com. Anya von Bremsen is an award-winning cookbook author and a global restaurant critic for Travel and Leisure magazine. Long before anybody paid attention to the rumbles of culinary revolution in Spain, Anya was charting each tremor, even the seemingly bizarre innovations. Hey, Anya, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
Now, you know, you're the one who has been fixated on Spain, and we keep hearing there is so much going on there. It's almost a revolution in what's happening in the restaurants. What's your take on all of this?
It's been building up tremendously, and now I think it has exploded. I don't know if you've seen the cover story of New York Times Magazine in August with this chef, Ferran Adrià, on the cover, pretty much saying that, you know, the culinary avant-garde belongs to Spain. And, of course, I've been reporting on it for almost the last 10 years, you know, when this whole thing just began. And now there's a real sort of explosion because this chef, Ferran Adrià, he's kind of the conceptual, the theoretical engine behind this movement, you know, completely changing the way that chefs around the world think about food. But following him, there's a whole generation of young chefs that are just doing astoundingly creative things, unlike anything that has been done in Europe before.
Why is this happening in Spain?
It's a good question. I think part of the reason is the just sheer genius of this guy, Ferran Adrià, and the strength of his conceptual ideas, because he's not just a chef, he's a theorist, he's a scientist, he's doing research into textures, you know, into flavors, combining them the way that was never done before, and also challenging the traditional perceptions of food. When you go there for his 30-course tasting menu, you just don't recognize the dining experience because sweet courses might come before the savory courses. Everything looks like performance art, you know, and every little dish makes you think. So here's one of the reasons. Spain is doing extremely well economically. It's really the leader in fashion, in culture. And Spanish diners are very non-committal. They will try anything once. You could never have this kind of crazy contemporary stuff going on in Italy or even in France, you know, who are still holding on to the traditions.
So some examples of what this food is about, what you're talking about.
Well, for instance, I'll just talk about a couple of chefs that have really impressed me recently. There's one young guy, he's 29, his name is Andoni Luis Aduriz, and he is in San Sebastian in a restaurant called Mugaritz. And just to give you an example, I had this foie gras there, and the texture was unbelievable, and it didn't taste like any foie gras I've had before. And I said, Andoni, how did you do this? And he started telling me, and the story began with him working with Institute for Liver Transplant, the most important one in Spain, to study the DNA of foie gras. So he did all this incredible scientific research. He gets the foie gras from Lund in France, which has the best foie gras in the world. He rejects 80% of it, choosing only the genetically superior specimens.
A DNA lab in the kitchen.
Then he cooks it in, you know, about six different ways. He smokes it lightly, then he sears it, then he does all the transformational things with it. So basically what he detests is this like globby fattiness.
Yeah.
So it tastes incredibly smooth and unlike any foie gras you've ever tasted before. And it's like an essay in altered states. And then he serves it in this, you know, very austere Japanese inspired smoked tuna broth with sour cherries that are kind of bitter. So he completely rewrites the history of foie gras as this luxurious, fat oozing dish with a sweet sauce. And this is the kind of stuff that's going on. It's not just about doing savory ice creams or foams, you know, all the stuff we talked about before.
Right.
Now it's very scientific.
Well, you know, it makes sense in one way because technology is so much a part of our lives that, you know, it would start to enter in food preparation in
oh,
this
absolutely.
Way.
Absolutely. There's another chef, there's a group, three brothers in Catalonia, in a city called Girona, which is a very kind of hip happening place. And the younger brother, for instance, is doing desserts that are at Trump Loyal's perfumes.
And when you say Trump Loyal, you mean trying to be
they,
like...
They completely resemble the smell of a perfume. You know, the guy is a young guy, who was like a punky kid, you know, no one knew what to do with. And now he spends all his time in Sephora, you know, in the cosmetic shops, smelling all this. Well, I was thinking, like, what is he doing in Sephora? He's smelling all this perfume, and then he replicates their aroma through his desserts. And he calls them after perfumes. For instance, he's got something called Lancôme Tésor, which is a layering of loquats, apricot sorbet, warm peaches, and then lilac roses, mallow. And what happens at the restaurant, they give you a stick, a paper stick of the real perfume to sniff, and then they present you with this dessert. And as you eat it, it exactly smells like the perfume. Plus, it tastes unbelievable. You know, he's doing Ralph Lauren's Polo. And then he's doing another dessert called Anarchy, which has 45 different flavors and textures arranged on the plate. And you mix them at whim, and each flavor brings a completely different sensation. And no two tastes are ever replicated because everyone eats it in a different way. So these are some of the things that are going on in Spain. Besides, you know, the food looking stupendous and being always provocative and always light, and just so challenging to the senses.
Anya, this is really incredible. Hey, thank you.
You're welcome.
Anya von Bremsen writes for national publications, including Travel and Leisure magazine. She's also working on a book about the world's 80 great dishes. So for a little classical Spanish, you can find her recipe for paella on the website, splendidtable.org. Beer authority Stephen Beaumont will go just about anywhere in the world there's beer, which means he goes nearly everywhere. Stephen reports his finds on his website, in his books, and here on The Splendid Table. Hey, Stephen, welcome back. Good to have you here.
It's nice to be back, Lynn.
Steve, I've been wondering about a difference. People tell me that lager beers and Pilsner beers are different. But what exactly is the difference?
Well, the first thing you need to know is that a Pilsner is a type of lager beer. And the reason it's called a Pilsner is because the style was invented in the town of Pilsen, in what we now know as the Czech Republic. It was 1842 when the brewers in the town of Pilsen decided to get together and form one brewery so they could compete more effectively against the other brewing companies in Bohemia. And they imported a German brewer named Josef Grohl. Now, Josef Grohl was, by all historical accounts, not necessarily a terribly good brewer, but he was a very lucky one. And his luck was to be in the town of Pilsen, where they had this wonderful hop called the Saaz hop. And Josef Grohl was able to combine bottom fermentation, which was something new out of Germany. They didn't know that much about it, but it was that lager fermentation that gave a crisper, cleaner flavor to the beer.
Mm-hmm.
The Bohemian hops, the Saaz hops, which are very floral. The soft water in Pilsen, which had a lot of effect on the flavor. And also this new malt that was available, which was very light in color. So he created the world's first golden lager. Everything that came after that is related to that Pilsner in some way, shape, or form. Tastes like it.
So that's how that golden light beer essentially came into being.
Exactly. Because before that, they had a difficult time malting grain. In other words, making the grains ready for brewing. And their grains would get darker in color. So now they had a new technique. They could make a lighter colored malt, which produced a lighter colored beer. And that became known for the town of Pilsen as Pilsner.
And is it still made there?
Well, there's a beer called Pilsner Urquell, which is the original source Pilsner. And it was the beer that Josef Grohl brewed in 1842 and is still brewed today.
And is this now that same kind of combination of elements? Does that actually make the Pilsner beers that we have from other parts of the world?
Well, you know, there are a couple of mainstream commercial beers that call themselves Pilsners, but they're really not a lot like Pilsner Urquell. To be a true Pilsner, you have to have a pronounced hoppiness. And the Czechs are known for this type of blonde lager with a good hoppiness and a dry body. There's another beer just down the road from Pilsen that you may have heard of. It's called Budweiser.
Yeah, you're kidding. That comes from Czechoslovakia or the Czech Republic?
Actually, this one's called Budweiser Budvar, and it's made in the town that used to be called Budweis. So that's where the name Budweiser came from. You can find this beer in the United States not as Budweiser, but as Czechvar, because it can't use that name to be sold in the United States. But it is a marvelous beer, a model of restrained complexity. It's both very, very refreshing and tasty, but it also has a wonderful complexity to it.
But it doesn't have the great team of horses. Hey, yeah. Stephen, thank
no
you.
No horses. My pleasure, Lynn. Cheers.
Well, Stephen Beaumont is author of the Premium Beer Drinker's Guide. Now, you can find Stephen's beer information posted on the website, splendidtable.org. Over a year ago, we reported on a struggling cattle rancher rolling the dice for financial survival. Dan O'Brien ran cattle on his Broken Heart Ranch. But Dan is also a biologist who began to see the Great Plains through different eyes. Now, add to that mix a chance encounter with 13 baby buffalo, and you have Dan O'Brien, buffalo rancher, with an ecological mission. But financial ruin was still just around the corner. Well, reporter Yoon Kerr made a return trip to the Broken Heart Ranch to see how that roll of the dice turned out.
Dan O'Brien is a man with a problem. It's a good problem, but a problem nonetheless.
The demand seems to be, for this particular kind of buffalo meat, seems to be, we sure haven't found the bottom of it.
Dan O'Brien sells grass-fed buffalo meat from animals raised on the prairie. He's sitting outside the Sweet Grass Grill near Deadwood, South Dakota. It's part of the Tatanka Buffalo Interpretive Center. The grill prepares dishes made from O'Brien's buffalo. While he's delighted by the success, he's constantly thinking about its implications. The first year, he and his business partners in the Wild Idea Buffalo Company slaughtered 6 buffalo. Each 1,000-pound animal provides about 400 pounds of marketable meat. They worried whether there would be enough demand to sell all the meat. There was. The herd has grown steadily ever since, and a couple of years back, they bought a second ranch so they could run more buffalo.
Last year, we sold 180 animals. So already we've outgrown the second ranch, and we're not really fully on to it.
Buffalo advocates argue it's healthier eating because of its low fat content. Grass-fed buffalo fans say the meat simply tastes better. Whatever the attraction, Wild Idea Buffalo is at a crossroads.
At this point, it's large enough that business people really need to do it. I'm a writer, for gosh sake, you know. I mean, I'm a writer. I love food. I'm a writer. And it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work, you know, dealing with customers and all that kind of stuff. And so our question is, you know, what do we do from here?
The answer to that question lies next to what Dan O'Brien calls the new ranch. You have to make an effort to get there. You drive about 15 miles out of Rapid City until you come to a dirt road branching off to the south. There's another 25 miles of bumping, twisting, and turning to reach the ranch entrance. The ranch house road is a couple of miles further yet, but if you keep going straight and enter one of the huge paddocks, that's where you meet the buffalo. On this dry afternoon, it's in the 90s. The almost constant prairie wind provides little cooling. The buffalo seem unbothered despite their shaggy manes. These animals evolved here and are just as at home in the heat as when it's 20 below with 2 feet of snow on the ground. There's about 100 of them. When a vehicle approaches, the entire herd runs towards it. It's a scary sight for the uninitiated as the huge shouldered animals hurtle across the prairie. They circle round, then slow, and stop to graze. This is one of two herds owned by the Wild Idea Buffalo Company. The other is at Dan O'Brien's original ranch near Sturgis. The ranch hands occasionally move the herds from one paddock to another to rest the grass. Otherwise, the animals are left to their own devices here, living much as they would have in the days before white settlement. This land lies adjacent to an area of federal land called the National Grasslands. For years, it's been leased out to ranchers to run their cows. Until now, the area wasn't open to buffalo ranchers, but Wild Idea just got permission to fence 20,000 acres. It means that Dan O'Brien and his associates will have to build 23 miles of buffalo-proof fence. It'll take a while, probably a year, but they'll be able to double the size of the herd. Even as they begin driving fence posts, they'll be doing the annual slaughter. It's a far cry from modern slaughterhouse practice. A sharpshooter kills selected animals in the paddock. It means extra work, because the carcasses have to be quickly transported to a processing plant for butchering and vacuum packing. But O'Brien says he does it out of respect for the buffalo. He says it's more humane. They die where they lived. It's much less stressful than a trip to the slaughterhouse. Stressed animals have more adrenaline in their system, which can change the taste of the meat.
We'll probably slaughter 10 animals a week for a while, and then maybe bump it up to 20 animals a week and be done by middle of the winter.
Dan O'Brien talks like a businessman, but he's on an environmental mission. He writes books about his love for the wild open spaces in the northern plains. In his book, Buffalo for the Broken Heart, he argues putting cows on the northern Great Plains was a man-made disaster. He says cattle ravaged the prairie and disrupted the balance of the ecosystem. He claims there's been a tremendous human cost, too, as generations of farmers and ranchers have struggled and failed in the harsh climate. He says developing a sustainable way of ranching buffalo can help humans and the prairie. Wild Idea's grass-fed buffalo isn't cheap, about $7 a pound for buffalo hamburger, much more for finer cuts. But O'Brien says there is clearly a demand for naturally raised meat.
I was in Denver not too long ago, and they had salmon on the menu, and someone at the table next door asked the exact same question that I was about to ask the waiter, you know, are these farm-raised salmon? And the guy said, yeah, and he says, I'll have a steak. And I think that that same mentality is going on with buffalo. You know, are these grass-fed buffalo? Are these real buffalo? Or were these things in a feedlot?
Dan O'Brien says there's a lot of work ahead, but he's confident. All he has to do is find the help.
So, yeah, I'm locked into it. But I would like to, as much as I can, I'd like to stay on the idea end of it and let somebody else put the fence posts in.
23 miles of buffalo-proof fence. That's a lot of posts. I'm Ewan Kerr.
Rancher Dan O'Brien is author of Buffalo for the Broken Heart. Ewan Kerr is a news editor for Minnesota Public Radio. Well, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. What food from the Americas traveled to Europe and changed the population of two countries? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by SuperTarget, offering ingredients for your favorite recipes, from real semolina brass-cut Italian pastas to a wide variety of European cheeses. You can visit them online at Target.com to find a store near you. Now, we're going to be taking your calls in a minute. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. But first, here's the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what food from the Americas traveled to Europe and changed the population of two countries? Well, it was the potato. The potato delivered more calories per acre than any other crop at that time. And the potato flourished in places like Ireland. You know, it had terrible soil and a difficult climate. Between 1760 and 1840, Ireland's population increased 600%. And without the potato, it never could have happened. But the little tuber betrayed the Irish. When the potato blight hit, the people had no other food source. And because of the cashless economic system, you see, they traded labor for rent. They had no money to buy other food. And so the potato brought change to a second country. Desperate for survival, hundreds of thousands of Irish immigrated to the potato's home hemisphere, to the Americas. And the circle was complete. The lines are officially open. You can get to us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Let's get right to those phones. We have got Jeffrey calling from Seattle.
So, hi, Lynn.
Hello, Jeffrey. What do you want to talk about?
It's time for my annual plea for help. I'm the guy that has the cocktail party every year.
Oh, where, yes.
Mm-hmm, I explore a different lounge theme of the 1950s. And I always love your help with my hors d'oeuvres. That's very important. The cocktails are important, but so is the food at these events. So.
You did the James Bond party, as I remember.
I spy cocktails, yeah.
Right.
Cocktail Shanghai, and last year was Cocktail Roundup. It was a rodeo theme.
I remembered you had people playing poker in one room. And
yep. Oh, yeah. Yep, the saloon room had the poker game going on. That's right. And this year, I'm actually going to do a slideshow lecture about remaining tiki bars that are through North America. So it's going to be a lot of fun. It's a tiki theme, kind of tropical, not exactly Hawaiian, a little bit darker than that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But, you know, the tiki theme with Trader Vic's kind of a look to it.
Now, what can I help you with this
year? Well, I'm just not sure what I want to do for my hors d'oeuvres. You know, I want to do things with pineapples and coconuts and shrimp and anything that's sort of easy to make ahead and serve cold is always a plus.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. And when you mentioned Trader Vic's, you know, there's an hors d'oeuvre, but it's hot. That's the only thing.
Well, okay. I could do one or two of those.
Okay. It's called rumaki.
Well, I've never heard of it.
Well, I'll explain. What it is it's marinated chicken livers that's been marinated in soy sauce with ginger, a little white wine, and brown sugar. Okay.
Chicken livers?
Yeah, little chicken livers. Now, you want to use them from organic chickens because, you know, you don't want people glowing in the dark and all that. And then what you do is, or you can do this with a prune if you don't want to use chicken livers. You stuff it with a chunk of water chestnut. You just push it in the center. You wrap the whole thing in bacon, stick a toothpick in it. It's a mouthful. And you run it under the broiler.
Okay.
So you get the sweet kind of spicy flavor from the chicken liver or the prune. You know, you can use pitted prunes.
Okay.
You get the real crunch of the water chestnut. And you can make these all up ahead, and you can do them on a grill or you can do them under the broiler. And then, of course, there's the coconut shrimp. You know, I mean, this is either, you know, fry the shrimp with a coconut batter.
Yeah.
But there's, you know, I have a way I cheat with this.
Do it.
Here's the cheater's way. You buy something like Thai curry paste.
Mm-hmm.
It comes in little pots.
Mm-hmm.
And what you do is you saute that in a little bit of oil with lots of garlic and onions.
Yeah.
And it's going to be spicy. You throw in some coconut milk, again from a can. If you can't get fresh, don't worry about it. You add your shrimp. You briefly cook your shrimp in that, pull them out, boil that all down, and then toss the shrimp into it. And you eat the shrimp with toothpicks or with your fingers, and you just top it with toasted shredded coconut.
Oh, that's perfect. I've got a great chafing dish that'll work, I think.
I think that'll be super. And, of course, how about grilled pineapple for dessert?
Oh, yeah.
Wouldn't that be neat?
Yeah.
You know, that's the kind of thing you stick a toothpick. I love toothpicks, you know, because I can put it in my mouth and I can toss it into a bowl or something.
Exactly.
So those are a couple of ideas. But,
those
sounds
are all
like
great ideas.
Now, is everybody going to have to come in sarongs and that kind of stuff?
Absolutely, yep. People get very, you know, very worked up about it. They plan for weeks in advance and everybody is going to look so fantastic this year. It's going to be an easy one for people to dress up for, I think, too.
Do they get self-tanner at the door?
I might put a giant tiki waterfall at the door, actually, they could do that.
I'm so glad you just pulled together these things at the spur of the moment.
Oh, well, I don't know about that. Yeah, it's a year-long event to get it ready, but the food, I need to get working on that. It's in 2 weeks. So.
It's in 2 weeks? Well, we will look forward to the pictures.
All right.
This is good.
Thank you so much, Lynn. It's been a big help. Thanks for talking to me.
Oh, hey, you're welcome. And you got a real, you know, you have a future ahead of you, party planner.
Oh, boy, I could love to do that. All right, aloha.
Aloha. Goodbye. We hear from Jeffrey every year, and every year he sends us pictures. And let me tell you, he stops at nothing to pull together these parties. They're just great. Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see who's up next. We've got Kathy calling from Minneapolis. Kathy, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I have a question about maintaining cast iron. I have a little cast iron skillet and what looks like, I think, a shortbread pan that I picked up at Goodwill, believe it or not. And I made the mistake of putting them in the dishwasher. One of them came out looking a little rusty. And I'm wondering, how do I get the rust off? Is it going to involve elbow grease? And beyond that, how do I season these pans to use them?
This is a good question. And Goodwill and places like that, great sources for saving money on cast iron. All right, this is what you want to do. You're going to take steel wool, you know, like Brillo, that kind of thing. And this is the last time you're going to use anything like that on the pans. But what you're going to do is scrub them out really well with water and Brillo to get rid of any rust, any crud, you know, that kind of thing. You're going to wipe them dry and then put them over very, very low heat and let them dry out completely on the stove.
Okay.
Once you've cooled them down, rub the inside of both pans very generously with a flavorless oil, okay? And you put that into a 300-degree oven, and you forget about it for an hour.
What do you mean by flavorless oil?
Well, it could be like a canola oil, could be a corn oil, could be a soy oil.
Okay.
Got the idea?
Uh-huh.
You know, a vegetable oil. Then the next thing you do is you cool it down. You kind of wipe out any excess oil, and you wipe it again, and you put it in the oven again. Now, obviously, you don't have to stand there for the whole hour.
Okay.
But you want to do that process 3 times because that helps permeate that metal with a slick of oil. And then when you've taken it out of the oven for the last time, make sure it's cool, wipe it out completely, and store it away. And what I usually do is I always put a piece of paper towel on the inside of the pan so that that surface isn't going to be marked up by the bottom of another pot.
Mm, okay.
Now, whenever you use the pan, what you're going to do to clean it is just do hot water and scrub it with a bit of salt and then always dry it over heat.
Oh.
Okay.
Hot water and salt.
Right. Just a little salt and then scrub it out. It'll be perfectly clean.
Okay.
But no more soap, no more, nothing else that's an abrasive.
Okay.
All right? And that's it. That's the whole thing. And each time you use it, it's going to get another coat and another coat and another coat. And eventually it's going to be like a nonstick pan.
Oh, terrific.
Yeah. You are going to love cooking in these things.
Well, thank you.
You are welcome. Enjoy.
I appreciate it.
Take care, Kathy.
Bye now.
Goodbye. Reach us at 800-537-5252. We have Mark calling from Colfax, Wisconsin. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Well, I'm a really big fan of Iron Chefs.
Right.
I watch it all the time.
Uh-huh.
They have an ingredient that I don't know what it is. It's called Swallow's Nest, and I'm assuming it's some kind of a seafood.
Well, no, I'm going to break this to you really gently.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's really the nest of a bird. And it's a tremendous delicacy in China. And I remember years ago, it was $35, $40 for one.
Well, they did one feature where that was their feature item.
Both chefs
did not have very much, and it was $24,000 worth of swallows.
Oh, my gosh. Good Lord. I mean, that's getting up there with truffles, for goodness sakes. I think I've tasted it two or three times. I've never actually worked with it, but I remember studying how to work with it. And what it is I think these are birds from southern China, I think. And they are swallows, I guess. And they have, when they build their nests, like most birds, evidently when birds are building nests, their saliva changes so that it's actually gluey or sticky. So that the nest, you know, nature allows them to make the nest. And what is done is that that nest is taken, you know, after the swallows are done with it. It's sold for a tremendous amount of money. And what you generally do is you soak it in water about an hour or 2 hours. Some people do it overnight. I'm going to get really graphic here. You pick out the debris and the feathers in the nest. Yeah. You rinse it and then you cook a soup with it.
Huh.
Doesn't that sound attractive? But it is a great delicacy. It's banquet food in China. And I have had it. It's very delicate. Some people say it's so delicate to taste that it doesn't have any taste. But that's a matter of opinion. But usually it's done in a rich broth.
Yes.
And it has bits of ham and threads of egg white. I mean, this is really celebratory food. But that's what it is. It's really the nest of a bird.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, and if someone ever offers it to you, it would be insulting not to take it and be very grateful for it.
Absolutely.
Hey, thanks for a great question, Mark.
Thank you.
You take care.
Yeah.
Goodbye. Well, a new cookbook came in this week, and it brought back something that happened to me in 1993 in New Orleans. We lunched at a new restaurant there. It had gotten great reviews. Now, the lunch was superb, but what came with dessert was even better. The young chef sat down to talk. Now, Passion was his middle name. He went on for 2 hours about how he worked, how he tried to inspire his staff, and we were totally enchanted. Well, I think after a decade, it's time to check in with him. Hey, Emeril Lagasse, welcome to the Splendid Table.
Hello, Lynn. How you doing?
I am fine. Do you remember the food you talked about that day?
I sure do. I absolutely sure do. I can tell you that it was banana cream pie with banana crust and caramel. I remember talking to you about how this dish of New Orleans called barbecue shrimp had inspired so many families, and that I had taken the dish and sort of dismantled it and did my version of it, which was using the shells and the heads into this reduction, served with little petite rosemary biscuits. And I'd also talked about how I admired you for so long. And your book was one of the top ones on my shelf. And you really sort of back then cleared up for me how to make the perfect risotto. I don't know if you know that, but that's really true.
I didn't realize that. You know what I remember? Now, this may have slipped your mind, and I've never forgotten this. You told me that you and your staff had decided you were going to work with fresh hearts of palm. So you had an entire palm tree.
That's correct.
Delivered to the restaurant. And what I remember was, this is what stuck, you said, we got to know that palm tree, and we gathered around it, and we learned to love that palm tree. I have never forgotten that kind of curiosity.
Well, you know, something that we started from day one with the restaurant was that every meal period, which is called pre-meal, we talk about food, we talk about wine, we talk about the customer, we talk about that evening as far as what is being inspired by seasonality or by the back door by our farmers.
Mm-hmm.
When you were there, I had a family who were growing hearts of palm for us in Costa Rica, and somehow didn't know how I could, but I got this tree in. And so the first day at pre-meal, we talked about the tree. We talked about how it's cut and where the hearts of palm comes from. The second day at pre-meal, we talked about how they're processed, meaning they have to be cured because you just can't eat raw hearts of palm without some sort of curing or blanching. And so we did that. And the third day, we had done several things on the menu not only as a salad, but using them in one of the entrees. And it was, and we still do that today, every single day.
You do? Because that was my question. Is there still time in your life for that kind of curiosity?
Absolutely. My chef de cuisines, all of them have been with me since day one. So I'm very, very blessed. The young man who is the general manager at Emeralds right now, when you were there, was the busman. And so there's this tremendous loyalty and wanting to be together and wanting to grow together.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, that passion every day is still discussed, whether it's about some new cheese that we just found or maybe something old that we brought in from Italy. And we're still having a blast every day talking about food, our passion, talking about wine, and how we can excite the guests, which is more important.
So what's next for you at this point with everything you've done?
You know, I'm working crazy, but I'm having so much fun. I'm still writing. Of course, they haven't fired me yet from TV, so I'm still doing television 10 years later. I'm getting ready to open a new restaurant in Miami. I have a six-month-old son.
Congratulations.
And I'm healthy, and I'm blessed. And so, you know, getting up every day is a joy. And trying to influence one person a day to make them a little bit more excited about eating or about the family table or about shopping or about wine is the thrill to get up every day.
Well, Emeril, thanks for taking the time to talk. I am never going to forget the palm tree.
Thanks so much, Lynn.
You take care.
Thank you. I can't wait to see you.
Take care, sweetie.
Thanks so much.
Emeril Lagasse's latest book is from Emeril's Kitchen. Now, you can find his recipe for roasted red onions with thyme mascarpone mousse on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week, guys. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Fran Lebowitz. She said, ask your child what she wants for dinner only if she is buying. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And by the way, be sure to take a look at our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. I just can't leave you guys alone. You see, I have these ideas of what you could be eating every single night of the week. Okay, register for it on the site, and it's easy. Just go to splendidtable.org, and oh, by the way, it's free. Well, our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Castor.
PRI, Public Radio International.